Welcome to the next level. This is JVL here with Sarah Longwell and Tim Miller of the Bulwark. Guys, how are we all doing?
Well, I'm living in a dystopic hellscape of fire and plague in California, but otherwise I'm doing really quite well.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Republican National Convention.
Also that.
But a bing. We're going to talk about three things today. We're going to talk about the Republican National Convention. We're going to talk about the bizarre paradox of the 2020 race. And we're going to talk about the violence in Kenosha. But Tim is going to lead us off talking about the RNC. Tim, go.
Yeah, style and substance. I want to hit on both. Starting on the substantive side, I went into this a little bit after day one in the newsletter while JVL was deep sea diving, the most noticeable thing for me about the convention from a substantive standpoint has, besides the fact that every single speaker mentions school choice, which I can't even remember when Donald Trump last talked about school choice, so I'm curious what's going on there. But the other substantive thing that I've noticed is that there is this dichotomy between the two Trumps, the speakers who actually like Donald Trump and actually understand what Donald Trump's voters want and spend most of their time talking about cancel culture and how great the orange God is and talking about how wonderful things were before the China virus came to the country and was the invisible enemy. And then that's the thing that they mention about it, and focus on kind of these populist themes that drove Trump success in 2016. And then you have other speakers, including the president's wife, weirdly, and Nikki Haley and Tim Scott, who either act as if he doesn't exist at all, and their substance of their remarks are all about like interesting things that they've done, or interesting like or positive kind of traditional Republican-y bills that he signed, like opportunity zones, and then completely ignore kind of the main beating heart of Trumpism, the sort of popular cultural grievance. And I think maybe some of that is by design, and they're using kind of Nikki and Melania to appeal to the softer Republican female voters in particular who have left the party. I think that's a tough sell, but I also think part of it is like not by design, and they just have no kind of control over this. I mean, Trump's body language was very bad during Melania's speech last night. Like Tim Scott's speech very much read like it was written by Tim Scott's people. And so they're just kind of letting a thousand flowers bloom. And if one guy talks about how Joe Biden wants to empty the prisons and the next guy talks about how Joe Biden filled the prisons, like whatever, that's fine. Who cares? Nothing matters. It's Donald Trump. So, from a substance standpoint, that's been what stuck out for me for the first 2 days.
Sarah, what'd you think?
You know, one of the things, that I think I tweeted this, but that has struck me is that, you know, despite how anti-Trump I am, obviously I've been a Republican since I was like old enough to formulate a political opinion. And, oftentimes during this Trump era, there will be things that remind me of why I was attracted to the ideas of the Republican Party, very few of which exist these days. But I'm reminded like, oh, I still believe this thing or that, and still identify with certain when the Republican Party starts to sound like an old version of itself, I can like remember, oh, yeah, this is why I supported this party. I watched this convention and I have yet to feel even the remotest sense of identifying with these people.
The gun couple didn't
like that's
the,
it. Like,
the woman like just, and the gun couple family has a lot of similar traits to you. No,
they just, it feels like, and this has happened, I mean, really in the Trump era where I'm like, these are not my people. The conspiracy mongering, the apocalyptic talk, the over the top. I mean, look, you can criticize Democrats for a bunch of things on policy grounds, but they just saying socialism, socialism, socialism over and over is not, it's neither a fair characterization of the vast majority of the Democratic Party, which nominated the most centrist candidate in their field, with the exception of Mike Bloomberg, of course. Nor does it sort of, it just doesn't fit like the platform or the way that Joe Biden is even projecting himself. I mean, they literally, the Democrats just had a convention that featured a number of Republican speakers. They are clearly trying to signal being a big tent party. So anyway, it's just, I just, And also it's funny because it's actually pretty well produced in the sense that it is technically, they ended up, despite criticizing the Democrats for this, they filmed everything in advance. And so it's pretty seamless. It moves quickly from thing to thing, but it also gives it the effect of being very bloodless, very produced. I'm deeply bored throughout it. And the only time you really perk up is you're like, oh, because something insane is happening. Like Kimberly Guilfoyle is screaming at me. So I think that's, but that's been odd to me that like it triggers almost none of my sort of Republican or conservative instincts. But Tim, I will say I think one of the reasons that the school choice thing is popping just as an observation is probably because right now a lot of people on the right are sort of fighting with their local schools because they're trying to homeschool their kids and pot up with people. And so there's sort of like a weird COVID homeschooling school choice byproduct.
I do wonder, this is like the least important thing, but it's like, it just has been so striking to me. Like, do you think that that popped in their polling? Or do you think that like the speechwriter who wrote all the undercard speech, this is just a hobby horse for them? Or do you think it is what you're saying? Like this is,
I think, look, the thing that they're doing, I think they're not doing it particularly successfully, but it's very clear in their intent is that they've got sort of two buckets of people, right? That's why it's like a schizophrenic convention. There is one bucket that is like, this is the apocalypse. They're coming. MSM-13 is moving in next to you. And those are like base plays. But then there's this other suburban women play where they focus on like, you know, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott. I mean, you know, I don't want to steal JVL's point, but his idea about Earth 2, traditional Republican Party.
That was my point.
You wrote the Trump, the Earth 2?
I did. I wrote it for the triad, so I could see how you could be confused. And I know that you're not a regular reader of the triad.
That's why she wrote it. That's why she read it, Tim, because you wrote it and not me.
No, I read it. I always read it. I just read it. I thought it was extremely good. Anyway, I think that there is an explicit attempt to appeal to suburban women here. I think it's particularly well done, but I think that's why.
So Twitter informed me this morning that it was masterfully done and that it's working. And this seems to be the consensus on both left and right. Sarah, you have sat through dozens, scores, hundreds of focus groups. Can you gauge potential effectiveness of it for me?
So I'm doing two focus groups tonight, actually. One with women, but one from Arizona, one from North Carolina. And I can't wait to find out if it's working. I'm going to make a prediction that the vast majority of the people are not watching it. And that when I talk to them, they will not have an opinion about it, particularly one way or the other. But who knows? Maybe they are. I think that like, here's the thing, right? It's why whenever Trump, you know, does this new tone for like 5 seconds and the media throws him a ticker tape parade, the fact that this looks relatively normal and that Trump is doing things like naturalization ceremonies and pardoning people who have inspiring stories, like it just so exceeds the like unbelievably low bar that we all have for Trump that I think, especially for Republicans who are desperate to not look like they're constantly criticizing Trump, it's just an opportunity to be like, oh, this is good. See, look how normal this is.
Yeah. So I've got two things in this. One is that here's why I think it might be working, is that there's this group of people, and there are probably some of the people Sarah's just talking to in these focus groups that like went for Trump, but didn't like him. And for the last 6 months, all they've been reminded of were all the reasons they didn't like him. Like the stupid press conferences and the gassing of the protesters and the psycho Joe Scarborough tweets and the like whiny, you know, no responsibility behavior. And so they've left him. And then now for 1 week, they get sort of told, oh, right, these are the things that I liked about him. And these are the things that scare me about the left. Could that 1 week of that help claw some of those people back? I think possibly. I'm also interested to hear what the focus groups say. I'm not ready to weigh in yes or no, but thinking about it through that lens, I think possibly. And I do have, since this isn't live, I can say this, it would be breaking news, but I just right before I got on, got a call from the Wall Street Journal who wanted my take on, they're about to break that this naturalization ceremony, the at least two of the people were not told that it was going to be used in the convention or filmed or anything of that nature. So if it wasn't cynical enough, if it wasn't an illegal Hatch Act violation, if it wasn't a totally obviously cynical ploy to use these ceremonies that the president's administration have been trying to cut significantly, how many of them we have, and make it as hard as possible for people to have them. On top of that, it was cynical on the most personal level, and said they didn't even tell these people that they're going to be used as props.
Can we talk about the Hatch Act, Tim? Because this is one of those things, like, for instance, the Ukrainian begun impeachment hearings, where you have what is a clear violation of the law. And the answer is, well, the American public doesn't really care about it, so therefore the violation of the law doesn't matter.
Yeah, I actually think that this is more clear than the Ukraine. The Ukraine issue was so kind of arcane and, you know, involved kind of diplomatic norms. I do think it was complicated for regular folks to just understand, forget whether or not they care. And then, you know, there was all of the like extended figures of the, you know, Donald Trump extended universe and like minor characters and everything in the Ukraine thing. It made it a little bit indecipherable, I think, for people. This isn't. This is very decipherable. Like, the president is using the White House for political purposes, and it's inappropriate. And like I've said this, I said this on Twitter. Like, the Lincoln bedroom thing, how is this any different than that? Like, Bill Clinton was letting his donors sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. It was uncovered by the news outlet. The Republicans made a big stink about it. The media made a big stink about it. And that stink stuck with them all the way to it became an issue in Hillary's 2000 campaign against Rick Lazio. I mean, it didn't go away. And it was the same thing. Like, the crux of the matter was they were inappropriately using the people's house, you know, for political gain. That's what the president was doing last night. And maybe it's true that people don't care about that, but I think rather than like reporters being pundits and deciding that, maybe they should just report that what they were doing is against the law and inappropriate. And by the way, instead of the Democrats deciding that it's silly, you know, maybe they should hold hearings about it and do what Rush Limbaugh used to do. And, you know, about the Lincoln bedroom. I mean, I think that there's this, if the media is going to only decide that something is a scandal, if it's like a secret scandal, or if the other party makes a big deal out of it, then like the other party has to start making a big deal out of it, or the media is going to start behaving better. Like, those are the two options. And so I think the Democrats got to start making a bigger deal out of stuff like this, and the media's got to start behaving better.
Sarah, there's this truism that actual voters never care about process arguments. The Hatch Act feels like a process argument situation, the type of thing that people like us get ramped up about, but which will move exactly zero votes anywhere. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Is that
no? I actually really agree with Tim's point. I think that these things can become an issue if people treat them like they're the issue that they are. And this is one of the things where I think, look, I'm not the media, well, but I do think the media has failed in a way where they, just like what I just said about the low bar, he wins with this sort of soft bigotry of low expectations for Trump, right? Where they all expect him to break the law. And so rather than printing stories about how he is breaking the law and it's a real issue, and then creating that as a bigger issue, you know, it's just a straight reporting. He's breaking the law. If more people made a big deal out of that, instead of acting like pundits were there, instead saying like, yeah, he's doing this thing, but voters don't care. Like, well, voters might care if it was made to be the big deal that it is, if they understood that it was corrupt, right? I think like there's no education. Like, voters don't care about it because it's not being framed at all for them.
So JBL, I noticed you haven't provided any takes. You've just been asking queries, and I'm wondering if that's because you were just like drinking a lot of painkillers on your vacation and haven't actually tuned in. And we're hoping that you could get by without anybody noticing that.
I had a painkiller last night. I mean, I would say this. I disagree with you guys. I think that this is the type of thing that will not move a single voter anywhere. And I believe that we're going to sound like a broken record. This goes back to our age-old disagreement, which is that I think this is further evidence of the fact that it turns out our entire system of government is just on the honor system. And once both the principals no longer care about honor and the voters no longer care about honor, then we're just screwed. There is no way forward. Nothing works. And, you know, Donald Trump was the guy who discovered that this was all being done on the honor system and happens to be the first United States president ever who did not give a crap about honor, period, the end. And I just find it hard to believe that a country which was told that the president said to the authoritarian leader of China, "Oh, you're going to build some concentration camps? That sounds great. Go ahead." Is going to say, "Oh, no, Mike Pompeo violated the Hatch Act. Well, that's a bridge too far for me."
Well, JBL, okay, let me just object to that. What? Why? Okay, everybody likes to use the Hatch Act because it sounds silly. Like, it does sound silly. That's true. But let's put that part aside. What about the fact that, like, that we don't want a kink? Like, that these actions, like holding a political convention and having an honor guard and having them play music, you know, feels like a really weird, you know, North Korean or, you know, old Europe monarchical thing. And like that makes people uncomfortable. It doesn't that go in contrast to the whole kind of American spirit of what we want, of what people want? Could we not break through with voters on that? Like, do you really want this creepy wannabe king using the White House for this shit?
I don't think there is an American spirit on this stuff. There may have been 10, 20, 40 years ago, certainly like 200 years ago. But now the negative polarity is such that we have, as Adrian Vermeule said out loud, you know, I said out loud multiple times over the course of the last 6 months, maybe we should be going back to having a king who really embodies the will of the polity rather than relying on all this election stuff. You know what? He is saying out loud what his side all thinks, because everybody has basically decided that this liberal democracy stuff is all bunk. All that matters is that my side is running things. And you even see this on the left when you have, you know, you look at the polling data on people who are talking about First Amendment and free speech and then hate speech. There is a lot of, you know, if my side is making the rules, then I'm all for locking stuff down. And I think it's the same thing here. I just think this whole experiment has hit its terminus.
The American experiment?
Yeah, that one. Sarah, that's a bold take.
Tim, I mean, you can fight with him on this. I've been fighting with him about this for months and months and months because I disagree with this.
The American experiment has reached its terminus?
Yeah. I mean, like, I agree decline is a choice and that, you know, people are far too unserious and some of JBL's other critiques of it. But the conclusion that he arrives at is that, like, America's finished. And I'm not there. But like, look, the essential thing here that Trump has done, and we've talked about this a lot, is that he overwhelms the system with corruption. Like, the reason that the Hatch Act looks silly is because it pales in comparison to all the other corruption that is omnipresent in the day to day. And part of the reason that the media, you know, doesn't hold his feet to the fire on this is because it becomes impossible because there's just so much of it. Right.
And so, like, Kellyanne said when she was charged with this stuff, Kellyanne Conway literally said, as asked by a reporter, she goes, "Yeah, go ahead, have me arrested." This is their attitude. Like, what?
Yeah, and they're bad, and hopefully, and they should be voted out, and we should demand accountability on these things.
I just want to go back to the Lincoln bedroom thing really quick, just this analogy. And so maybe you're going to say to me, things have changed in 20 years, maybe, or 30 years, however long it's been. Maybe that's the answer. But this was an abuse of the White House. People complained about it. He got negative media coverage. Bush and Obama didn't do it. Like, you know, that was an example of an abuse of power that there were negative consequences for, and it yielded a result where people stopped doing that. Like, well, I just don't understand why we can't just do that right now for using the White House for really gaudy, you know, Kim Jong-un-esque political events.
So this is actually a pretty good segue into topic two, which is my the new paradigm that I'm using to look at the election is that this election is essentially a paradox in that we have as clear as we have had and as stable as we have had a lead for one candidate over another going back probably to like 84. And it has been Biden plus 6, 7, or 8 almost the entire time, even dating to the theoretical matchup polls before Biden was a declared candidate. Trump has never led. He's never been closer than 6, I don't think. He may have gotten like 5.8 once. And it's been, as Harry Anton at CNN has said many times, the biggest lead by and most consistent lead by a challenger over an incumbent president in the history of polling. That's the one side. So we know what people think. We know what the voters think about this. On the other side, because of COVID and then because of Trump, we have more uncertainty as to what the actual outcome would be than maybe any election we've had ever. Because all of the polling may turn out to be utterly useless if you have some very large percentage of votes coming in by mail and then aggressive challenges both at the federal and state level to disqualify ballots and a prolonged fight over, well, this signature only tangentially matches this other signature on the voter ID and registration card, then you're going to have the problem of fewer polling places, longer lines. You have no idea what turnout is going to look like, where a college student's going to be, right? On November 3, are college students going to be at college? Or are they going to be home? Everything about the actual vote casting and vote counting is as uncertain as it has ever been. And this puts us in a very weird, weird place. And I find it actually quite alarming because, again, if you were going to say the American experiment is finished, what would be the classic result? The classic result would be a clear majority opinion of the public on one thing and then an election result showing another thing, which is wildly disputed and which has both sides crying foul. This is what failed states look like.
Well, I like my new chair in a podcast with JVL because I always kind of feel like I'm the darkest one in conversations with people, but I'm like a bright shining beam of optimism compared to you, JVL. So I do appreciate that, Connor. I think that you're right. I think that in this sense, there is a potential very, very bad worst case scenario in this election, which is essentially that Joe Biden wins a very close election. There's a lot of chicanery around voting and vote counting. And, you know, Donald Trump comes out of that actually being a narrow victor and mass protests, riots, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't. What is the percent chance of that? I don't know. 4, 2, 6? I'm not sure, but I feel like we've had a run of bad luck here. So I'm hoping that we don't, you know, kind of draw that card. I mean, I think that in the more likely result is that Donald Trump wins, you know, or Donald Trump loses clearly. And then like whines about the count on Twitter and like sends some tweets about it. And then there's like this minority, maybe 18% of the population that thinks for all of eternity that Donald Trump got robbed by the deep state and the elders of Zion and the, you know, pedophile ring or whatever. And that's unhealthy for our democracy as well, but it's much more survivable than the situation that you paint.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little bit with JVL on this, where I am pretty worried about how the election's going to look. I think that even, Tim, you know, your scenario there where Trump wins narrowly, I actually think there's a different scenario that's much more likely, which is that all of the polls that have surveyed people on how they're going to vote show that people who are going to vote for Joe Biden disproportionately are favoring mail-in ballots. And the people who are going to vote for Donald Trump are disproportionately going to show up on the polls on election day. And so I think that you set up a scenario where on election night, which is when people are used to having elections called, you see you see Trump doing far better than any of the polls suggested, and it starts to look a lot like it did in 2016. And Meanwhile, there are, for no nefarious reasons, but for a series of bureaucratic reasons, the system is very overwhelmed by the number of mail-in ballots. And so people are counting extremely slowly. And then there's instances, in some places, credible instances, where people mailed in a ballot and they showed up to vote as well. And so Trump starts going nuts about the idea that there's fraud, widespread fraud, and starts calling for people, you know, for them to call. He's already tweeted this, that he wants the election called on election night, which favors him. And it just opens up this gray space for there to be things just to look muddled and to not look like Americans are used to them looking, and for then tons of litigation to drop, and for people to be in the streets. And that there's this phenomenon now they're referring to as the blue shift, right? So if you remember, Kristen Sinema on election night was behind Martha McSally. But as the votes came in and were counted, she became the winner. But that was days later. And Doug Ducey, of course, certified that election. But Donald Trump was tweeting about how it was, you know, stolen and rigged. And I think that you're going to about to see that whole thing happen on a national scale. And I think JVL's point about it dramatically impacting what these polls are only as good as A, a snapshot in time, and B, if all the people who are registering their opinion go and vote that way, or just go vote.
Yeah.
And like, we're going to be in a weird environment.
So I'll just be institutions guy, and Donald Trump is a man baby guy, and say that we had an election not that long ago in 2000 where the result was unclear for many months. And, you know, obviously there's still segments within the Democratic base. It feels like that election was stolen, and they bring it up from time to time and they're bitter about it, and it impacts their view of our government and our democracy and our institutions in a way that's unhealthy. But, you know, we moved forward. They didn't then throw their party into a dictatorship following that. They nominated John Kerry. And Donald Trump, you just said it, in Arizona, like, already played this game before. And all he does is send a couple of whiny tweets. He hasn't demonstrated that much interest in being a strong man. Like, even his strong man stuff, like, he wants other people to do, you know, like the, like Lafayette Square and like what, you know, Miles Taylor has been testifying about on the border. He hasn't demonstrated the will to kind of follow through on this kind of stuff. Now, maybe that all changes. I'm just saying, given what we know now, I feel like whiny Trump tweets and a minority of the Republican base feeling like this election was stolen from them, in the similar way to how the Democrats do in 2000, but with having someone spur them on in a much more irresponsible way than Al Gore did, to be kind of the most likely outcome from here. So that there's sunny side Tim for you.
So understood, but even, so take away the optimistic versus pessimistic view of this. What I'm trying to get at is that even the most basic arithmetic of this election is totally unknowable. It's a black box. And so we had 126 ballots cast in 2016. And I don't think that anybody could do anything more than just make a wild ass guess as to the number of voters we're going to see this time around. I mean, if I told you that the number was going to be 20 million less or 20 million more, we would both say, yeah, okay, those are probably about equally likely, right? I mean,
I agree with that. It's very unknowable. And by the way, just as a quick point, the Republican strategist that I talked to for that Rolling Stone thing, I mean, that's the smart ones. Like, that's their case for winning, right? Is both of those two options, right? Is that, like, COVID creates a big dip in Democratic voting. But I think that's less for them. They were talking less about the fact that they see big enthusiasm and that there's a lot of, like, you know, non-college white voters, that there could be a bigger surge than people realize. That might be wish casting, but that's what smart people on their side say. So I agree with you. I don't think even, you know, the people who are the biggest data nerds have a sense for it at this point. Because yeah, you have enthusiasm way up with COVID as a massive wild card.
And JVL, I want to say I really appreciate your take here, because I think if you go back and listen to the secret pod from maybe 6 weeks ago, you will find a bunch of you arguing that Trump has basically no path and me constantly arguing that things are up for grabs because of the all of the things with mail-in balloting and how different that was going to make things. So I'm just going to fight you. I'm just going to fight. Yeah. Okay.
I have totally.
You're always right. What happened?
I'm going to declare that a victorate. Yeah, we'll see. JVL thinks he's always right, but I think in this case,
What I was talking about was the sort of assumptions that we lived in a world of free and fair elections and that we weren't a banana republic. I mean, this was before the president started talking about moving the election date and started ordering the postal service to disappear sorting machines and stuff like that. I mean, it's just crazy. Okay. Also crazy, what's happening in Wisconsin, Sarah?
So I'm only going to talk a little bit about the facts on the ground on Wisconsin, because I think that they're still, you know, unfolding. You know, I was, even as we were sitting down, I was trying to figure out, you know, there has been another shooting of an African-American in the back 7 times. He is still alive at the moment. But it has set off a new round of protests in Wisconsin. And last night during the protests, 3 people were shot, and I believe 2 of them are dead. But during the protests, this weird thing happened where a whole bunch of just regular citizens showed up with big guns. And shockingly, that ended up, you know, not going well. But the
two deaths, then, right? I mean, two deaths.
Yeah, that's right. 2 deaths. I think 3 people were shot. 2 of them have been killed. But my observation, or the thing that I want to talk about, besides how tragic all of this is that I had asked in my focus group, now going a couple weeks back, how they felt about the protests, you know, going 6 weeks on, you know, and I think I talked about them on the Secret podcast. I talked about them on Charlie's podcast. And my overwhelming take was that people still felt very much on this, you know, that George Floyd had been killed and that it was awful. And but there was something else in the way that they were talking about it that stuck out to me. And it didn't really come fully into focus until I started to see some other data come through that I want to tell you about. So one of the things that they were saying in the focus groups was they were all saying, and I brought a couple of their statements where I asked, you know, it's been a few months since George Floyd was killed. And how do you feel about everything that's happening related to that? And one woman said, sad about what happened, but I'm sad about the response to it. There's good protesting that was done appropriately and well, but I think we're beginning to see already that now there's a lot of rioting and things that are awful. My son works in Manhattan and he could see an organization of looting. It's nothing to do with injustice or black rights. And that kind of thing is just incredible to me. Another person said, I have mixed feelings, anger for what happened and the act itself, but also anger about the looting. Looting isn't serving the message well, not doing anything for the cause, not adding justice to it, just adding confusion to everything. And then somebody else, I thought it was a horrible injustice, but now it's all a hot mess. They're destroying towns. It doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't be happening this way. And it was interesting in this open-ended question how many people automatically jumped to this idea of looting, rioting, and violence. Now, of course, part of this is because on Fox News, it is 24/7 around sort of Seattle and Portland and all of the things that are going on. But then there was some other data that showed up. So Pew came out with a poll recently that showed that violence is now the top five issues around which people are voting. And it is, I believe, 58% of people registered it very highly as one of the things they'd be voting on. It was just below COVID, which had 63%. And then I went and looked at some data around Black Lives Matter. So there had been this enormous surge in support for Black Lives Matter about 2 weeks after the George Floyd killing. People were really on their side. And that really came through in the focus groups. But since then, the support for Black Lives Matter has re-narrowed almost back to where it was before the George Floyd killings. And so I posited on Twitter.
Is that true? I haven't seen that poll. What is that? What's that from?
It's from Civics with a Q, the polling. It's not the only thing. The Washington Post ABC poll, Philip Bump had a piece about this, which I cited below the tweet that I had that really got picked up by right-wing Twitter that wants to say, like, yes, this is an issue. But what I said in my tweet was that I think that actually this violence, you know, early on, so weeks and weeks and weeks ago, people suggested that perhaps all of the protesting would redound to Trump's benefit. And I actually said that wasn't what I was hearing from the focus groups, and it wasn't what we were seeing. People were overwhelmingly on the side of the protesters. And it was almost, and I even said in the focus groups, especially with these women, more so than COVID, more so than the economy, the racial divisiveness was the thing that was really, they were really disgusted with Trump over. But I think as time has gone on and the precipitating event of George Floyd's death, that there has actually been a shift in public opinion away from the protesters as we've become, as the protests have become divorced in people's minds from the George Floyd killing, even though they're still about racial justice right now, people just see sort of violence and looting. And there's been a couple of really bad instances. I mean, there was one instance where the protesters were at a Ronald McDonald House which had a bunch of sick kids inside with their parents, and they were breaking the windows below and sort of terrifying people inside. And so I think I've had this feeling, like, based on the data and based on what I was hearing in the focus groups, and I'm going to press really hard on it tonight, that this could be a potential vulnerability for the Democrats. And I think that it's clearly showing up in Trump's data, because there's a reason this entire convention and Trump has been really focused on this law and order message, and it's what they're pushing with their money, because they think it's the one thing that shot that they have to really paint this as a violence problem in Democratic-run states and cities and tie it to the Democrats and say, well, this is going to be Joe Biden's America. Now, of course, the obvious rejoinder to that is, well, this is actually happening in Donald Trump's America. And that's obvious, but I'm not sure.
Or the other rejoinder might be that, you know, it was Donald Trump's chief strategist who, you know, robbed his own supporters to build a fake wall. It's Donald Trump that's, you know, broken the law time and time again. All of his staff members are in jail. It's kind of a weird messenger for the law and order. But I guess law and order really only means that, like, black people have to follow the law, right? Not rich white people.
Yes. So, and I stipulate all of that. That doesn't change the fact that if support is dropping across the board for protesters, that there's not a kind of recency bias in people's minds where they end up rewriting a lot of the things that Trump did that they were furious about, his overreach. You know, right now, so in Wisconsin, they're sending in the National Guard, not just the Wisconsin National Guard, but Trump is sending federal troops. He's been tweeting about it today. And so I guess my question for you guys is, do you see a possibility that this could actually work to Trump's benefit and help him with suburban voters?
Jamie, I want to kick that one to you because I'm riled up, and I'm just like, right now, my little blood pressure is growing over here, so I just kind of want to let it build and build while you answer, and then I can bat clean up.
Let your tea kettle boil. Is it possible? Yes. You know, funny, Sarah, listening to you talk about the movement in the polls on this, I thought about the Ukraine stuff. I don't know if you guys remember, but there was a moment when it looked like there was a huge shift in public opinion on Ukraine, right? It was right after we got the smoking gun letter, I think. Was that it? Right. With the quid pro quo in it. And everybody was outraged. And then 3 weeks later, it had just been normalized. Like, yeah, this is just a thing the president does. He's a good Republican. We got to support him no matter what. And all the critics just shut up about it. And maybe that's what this is, right? It's, you know, everybody. So what you will get is you will get people, well, I thought that the George Floyd thing was terrible. But this other stuff with you know, Jacob Blake, that was very different, right? I mean, he was really, really bad, and, you know, he wasn't innocent the way George Floyd was. And now look what they're doing there. I could absolutely see that. So much of this, I think, God, I'm going to sound like I work for The Nation or something. I just feel like it's impossible to disentangle it from race. I mean, all it is coded appeals to racism. And the racism is so endemic and shot through. I was blown away by there's a moment in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, one of their pieces about the last night's protest, right, where a guy who seems to be a white militia member murdered two people who were out protesting. And there is a scene which is witnessed by a reporter from the Journal Sentinel. And there are a bunch of guys with long guns standing on the roof of a dry cleaner and, like, sighting at people and stuff. And the cops come by and they say, hey, you got to get down off that roof. And the gentlemen with the guns say to the police officers, no, we're not coming down off this roof. This is our building. We own it. I have to ask you, what do you think the law enforcement response would have been to an unarmed person who did not immediately comply with a police order to get down off of something. Do you think the police would have said, had it been an unarmed black person saying, no, this is my house, I'm not getting down from there. Do you think they would have said, oh, my mistake, I'm sorry. Yes, you can stay since you own that building. We're not going to force you. That wasn't a lawful order we were giving you. Or do you think they would have fucking shot him in the head? And this is, all of this stuff is, again, I sound like a crazy radical in this, but I just have run out of other ways to view any of these interactions and any of these political dynamics as anything other than just coded appeals to innate racism on the part of Republican voters and Republican leaners. Am I crazy, Tim?
Well, you're asking the wrong person, because I'm like, I've turned into a totally nation-reading Oakland radical on this. But it's just, look, stipulated. The looting is bad. Everybody agrees the looting is bad. You know who else agrees? Here's Joe Biden, just right now. We've been talking about this. Burning down communities is not protest. It's needless violence. Violence that endangers lives. Violence that guts businesses and shutters businesses that serve the community. It's long past time for the presidents to tell militias and street gangs to go home and to stop glorifying people famous for pointing guns at protesters. I mean, you know, there's Joe Biden. Everybody's like, why won't the Democrats condemn the looting? Every time somebody asks Joe Biden to condemn something, he condemns it. I don't know what more you want Joe Biden to do. So, like, is it a political matter? Is this going to work? You know? Yeah, probably. I don't know. It worked last time. People don't like looting. People don't like, you know, uppity black people, you know, who are trying to get back their, take back, you know, control of their lives. I say that in, you know, their words, right? I mean, yeah, there are racist people out there that look at this through a racist lens, and Donald Trump's, you know, attempts to try to pit people against each other are going to work. But there are other people for whom this doesn't work. You know, and that's the thing about those focus groups, is that for a while, the George Floyd thing was working more than COVID, because people were pissed that Donald Trump, you know, wasn't bringing the country together in the face of a grotesque murder of a black guy. And this thing yesterday, with Jacob Blake, or 2 days ago, I mean, he was... like executed. I know that he lived. I don't understand how he lived in front of his kids. His kids were in the back seat of that car. He had his back to the cops. Like what were they? I don't understand. They couldn't have tackled him. They couldn't have tased him. They couldn't have held him. Like what were they worried about? They had to shoot him 7 fucking times in the back.
Look at the timeline on this, Tim. Within literally 2 minutes, like 137 seconds of the cops showing up, they have opened fire on an unarmed guy. And that's the sort of crazy type of thing that can only happen if your police officers are grossly incompetent or willfully malicious. They're just,
and
are
there's a culture where it's okay. I mean, like I said this in the newsletter, in the United Kingdom last year, the police killed 3 people. Obviously, we're much bigger than the United Kingdom, but there were 1,100
and 1,000 times the size of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were multiple countries in Europe where they killed 0 people. The police killed 0 people. In Japan, the police killed 2 people. I mean, like this is we don't have to just accept that this is okay. And so yeah, I mean, some of the looters are the looters are out of control, but the guy that killed people in Kenosha wasn't a Antifa looter. He was a white nationalist who came to work with the cops to defend the town against the looters. So, you know, I mean, there are radicals on both sides of this who are acting inappropriately and acting violently. Donald Trump is trying to use this for political gain. And the Democrats should be doing as much as they can to defray that advantage. And thank God they nominated Joe Biden, because he's willing to do it. He's willing to condemn the looters, but they also should defray that advantage by putting this back on Donald Trump. They haven't mentioned Jacob Blake's name for 2 days at this convention. Has George Floyd been named at the convention over 2 days? I don't think so. You know, so like, yeah, he had a couple of speakers of color who talked about how great Donald Trump is. And that's great. Elevating diverse voices. That's great. But like, this is happening in this country because of the actions of the government and the
actions against black and brown people. And the president doesn't want to do anything about it. And even if the Black Lives Matter's numbers have come down, that's a message that's working in the suburbs and working with soft Trump voters. And we saw it. And the Democrats should continue to press that and not, you know, be like guilt tripped by people about like this handful of Antifa looter assholes that don't actually represent the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party nominated Joe Biden.
Sarah, you have this look of utter pain on your face as though Tim and I are turning off swing voters left and right as we speak. Is that what's happening?
You know, it's the thing is like substantively, I mostly agree with what you've said. But as an analytical matter, right, I am like, Wisconsin's a swing state. There is people are tired of violence in general. And that should automatically work against Donald Trump, you'd think, in a normal world. I'm just not sure that it will, because I think that Donald Trump is the one braying about law and order, braying about this happening in Democratic cities where they seem like they can't get things under control. Donald Trump gets to look like he's the big guy. And like, I don't know, Midwestern swing voters, that's what I'm thinking about. And I'm thinking about how this plays with them. And I'm just not sure that all of the stuff that you guys just said, I agree with, but I'm worried that the tide is turning.
Let's
to some
talk
degree.
About this frame for your, this is a serious question for these voters. So just putting on our analytical hats, not righteousness hats, but like, is the frame of I'm Joe Biden and I actually have called Jacob Blake's family and George Floyd's family, and I care about this and I want to heal the country and looting is bad. And I speak about that clearly. Is that frame worse than Donald Trump's frame, which is that Antifa is running wild and killing your communities and it's all Antifa's fault and I've never heard of George Floyd or Jacob Blake. I'm never going to talk about them. Like, which is a better frame for this voters that are up for grabs in this election? That's a genuine question.
Let me put it a different way, because JVL raised something that is exactly what I just said to a Wall Street Journal reporter who was asking me about this question. And I used
the Wall Street Journal called both of you guys for
about different stories,
but not me. Interesting.
Okay.
Go ahead. That's okay. I'm used to it.
I was the whole thing about impeachment. This is a really good example of where I felt like Democrats had a real advantage. Right? Public opinion is like cement. It is soft at first, and then it hardens. And the public opinion was really soft around impeachment. Oh my gosh, he did this thing and it was a big deal. And it was, the public opinion was moving hard against Trump. And then Trump dumped millions and millions of dollars in oppo on Hunter Biden and muddied the entire Ukraine question. Republican sentiment on it froze and then began to move back in Donald Trump's direction. And right now he is pushing one issue, which is the law and order issue. And he is framing himself as the person who can do it. And he's going to dump $100 million in swing states talking to white voters about why he's the law and order candidate. Now you tell, and I, so my concern, and it's not a like three alarm siren, because I think you're right. Joe Biden is Joe Biden, and it's not, he's not, you know, handling this the way I think Elizabeth Warren would be handling it. But I do worry that it could turn into a vulnerability for Democrats. And that's the question I'm posing to you, is seeing the world not as we want it to be, but as it is, could it be a vulnerability? And I'll just say one other thing, which is, I saw the clip of that Ronald McDonald House in downtown Chicago where there was these groups of men that were breaking the glass on the downstairs. And like, I found it very affecting. I was outraged that there was just people for no reason breaking the windows and terrifying people with sick children inside. And like, when you know that these voters are seeing that on a loop in the media that they consume. So I am just, it's, I think, like, it's
what
visceral.
What do those guys have to do with Joe Biden though? I mean, yeah, I agree. I can see that this could be a potential issue for them. And like, if Joe Biden could wave a magic wand and make everybody stop looting, he should do that, but like, he can't. He doesn't have any political job right now. And so do you really think that like the Ronald McDonald House looter guy is going to be able to be tied to Joe Biden? Like, the Joe Biden is going to let the Ronald McDonald looters roam free?
the crime bill guy. I don't know. I mean, maybe I could see how that would work for people who are stuck in the Fox disreality loop, who are never going to vote for Joe Biden anyway. But for the swing voters,
I think you're right. So here's one thing I'll say. I think you're right that it is not at all sticking to Joe Biden at the moment. My concern is that Trump is going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to try to make it stick. And that is the one area where, like, Trump hasn't really had a play, right? He can't get a toehold on Biden with anything. He can't get it with China. He can't get it with COVID. There's nothing. He can't get it with the socialist frame. This is the one place where I think it is possible that they could lay glove on sort of Democrats writ large and try to tie it to Joe Biden.
So what is the answer for Biden? If you guys were running his campaign and you recognize this as a potential area of vulnerability, what would you tell him to do?
So it's actually a tricky question, because you on one side of things, you don't really want to fight on his turf, right? You want to be on offense, on the things that work for you. And if you're Joe Biden, that's Trump's failures on the economy, on COVID, you know, that he is divisive and that you are a uniter. I do think that, though, Joe Biden should be making it clear. He's issuing press statements in which he stands with the peaceful protesters but condemns the violence. I'm not entirely sure it's sufficient. But, Tim, I'm really interested in what you think.
I think that Joe Biden's running a really great campaign right now. And so I haven't actually watched the video that he just put out about this. I just have read the quotes that I read to you.
Wait, did he put out a video?
Yeah, he just did a straight to camera thing addressing the Jacob Blake killing is the point of it. But he also addresses the looting. I think that's good. Yeah, I think it's good. I think that Joe Biden is doing the right thing on this right now. I mean, you know, I think that they should monitor it and be careful to speak out at times when it's appropriate to speak out and to condemn it. And I think that in the debates, it's going to be very important that he's forceful in condemning this when Trump, you know, tries to pin this on him. But I don't know. I've kind of stopped sitting in the chair of like trying to give pundit advice to the Biden campaign at this point, because like maybe it's been luck or accident or sheer genius of, you know, Steve Ricchetti. But I mean, they've every move they've made so far has been correct, and I've been pretty impressed by how they've staved off the tendency that literally every other single person of the two dozen people in that primary had to kind of appeal to the lefty Twitter wing. They haven't done it. And so I think stay the course is my advice.
Well, that was a good show, guys. Tim, you have always wanted us to disagree more, and I think we hit that mark today. Would you agree?
I agree. I like disagreeing. That's good. Nobody wants to hear us all tell us each other how great we are. You know, I mean, if they want to do that, then you know, they can look at Twitter and we keep retweeting each other, and there are plenty of vehicles.
Just so I don't get angry emails, to be clear, because this got me in trouble on Twitter, I'm doing this as an analytical matter. I'm like telling you what I see in the data and expressing a concern. That is not my opinion about things. I'm with you guys in a lot of the general outrage, but I think I see a shift happening and I'm worried about it.
I'm not sure I believe you. I read what Soledad O'Brien said about you, Sarah. I know what kind of person you are, lady.
I have been reevaluating my life choices.
I ladied you. All right, guys, good show. We will talk again at the next level next week.
Peace out.